You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Hank Phillippe Ryan back on the show with us today. She's talking about her brand new book, The First to Lie. And let me tell you guys what, if you are looking for a summer thriller, to have next to your bedside or on your shelf as your go-to, this is the book to get. The First to Lie, out available everywhere now. Welcome back to the show, Hank.
Well, thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here. It's you were saying it was a year ago that I was on your show before, and that is crazy.
It's been a crazy year, but man, does time fly. One thing we've been talking about a lot lately is this crazy pandemic and everything that people have been going through. Your day job, number one, you have a fascinating day job. But number two, your day job probably hasn't changed a whole lot during this pandemic. How has your life been going, over these last 4 months or so as a creative person and as an investigative reporter? How has this affected you?
How long do you have, Hank? It's the biggest change. I mean, who on the planet can't say the same thing right now? But every single aspect and element of my life is changed. And, on the one hand, given this situation, I'm lucky as a crime fiction author. I spend a lot of time right here at this very same desk at home by myself writing. And so that supposedly hasn't changed much. As an investigative reporter, though, that has changed quite a bit, because so much of what I did was out in the world and out in the public and with a camera and a microphone, talking to people and following leads and tracking down clues and doing research and being on the site of certain things. And so that's all really gone away. And my producer and I are diligently trying to do good stories by Zoom and by the internet. And, it's a completely different way of working and a completely different way of thinking. And our interviews are all done by Zoom. And, luckily there are things you can do online that, it doesn't matter what's happening in the outside. So we persevere. I think that's all you can really do right now is just persevere. And we still have a story on every week and we do our best. And under the constraints that we have, I think the bar is different level now from people. They don't expect fancy stuff on television. They just want the real scoop, straightforwardly given. And we provide that. And I'm very gratified and happy to continue to do that. As a crime fiction author, this is interesting because I really thought in my own sort of looking at the bright side kind of way that when the lockdown started here in Massachusetts, I thought, well, that's okay. That's the worst thing that could possibly happen. But I'm a writer and I will just pretend that it's just a snow day and I'm inside and it's a snow day and I have a lot of time to write. And won't that be great? I can really get a lot done. And I was 100,000,000% wrong. For weeks, I could not write at all. And I don't know whether you've heard this from other authors, but there was just this sort of scattered, my attention span would not stick. And there was this sort of veneer of terror over everything and kind of an underlying, why does this matter anyway? Because everything is awful. And I finally realized that, we chose being an author. I chose being an author and we all chose being writers because we thought it was a valuable, important, profession, that it was a thing that we can do, a cultural, a philosophical, an entertaining, an important thing that we all do. And because the world is even more terrifying now, doesn't make that any less valuable. I started sort of thinking, well, it's even more important than I do this now. I always say it's always safe inside a book. And whether you're writing the book or whether you're reading the book or both, that kind of entertaining, thought-provoking, fast-paced, totally immersive story, that story can always take us away. We can be someone else for a while. We can make someone else's decisions for a while. And I think it's valuable. I think it's valuable. Do you know, there's a movie, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's a Preston Sturges movie called Sullivan's Travels. Do you know this at all?
I don't.
You would absolutely love it. And in it, there is a flashy movie producer who has decided that he wants to make important movies, that's all that matters, important movies. And it's a journey of how he realizes that entertainment is valuable and that laughter is valuable and that having people be totally immersed in an entertaining story is about the most important thing you can do. Sullivan's Travels, I guess it's from the 30s or 40s, a Preston Sturges movie that I highly recommend. If we ever thought about what we're doing isn't important enough, what we're doing as authors and writers and creatives isn't important enough, that movie, it has Veronica Lake too, will completely change your life about it.
It's 1941 because I just Googled it while you were talking, and I just grabbed it from Amazon Prime. We're going to watch it tonight. That sounds amazing.
Wonderful. Well, what does it say about it?
It says it's a comedy romance from 1941.
It's about writing, and it's about creativity, and it's about imagination, and it's about humanity. And I think it's a fabulous movie. I'd love to hear what you think.
Absolutely. Well, I will report back to you. You got it. One thing that's really interesting to me, Hank, is looking back over the past 4 months or so, 6 months, I guess, really, when we really first started talking about this, is the way that the story of this virus has evolved and grown, changed in some respects. You know, I see the parallels between being a writer and I think about things like you do as a crime writer, because in a lot of your books and the new one, you take a subject that that is ripe for conspiracy theorists. You've got this pharmaceutical company that's kind of at the heart of the story that you're telling. We've all heard stories about nefarious companies that do things and they hide it from the public and all of that. How do you feel about the perception of the COVID-19 virus and how it's affecting our society and then how we respond to it? And do you look at it differently as an author as opposed to being a reporter? And do you get to pick up on things that might be helpful in your career later?
Oh my goodness, what a question.
Yes. That's such a loaded question. And there was like 18 questions in one.
It was. And I'll just say yes. Next question. You know, it's interesting because I can finish one of these sentences, I know. At the beginning of the pandemic, my husband and I were watching the news nonstop, all the time, every minute. And I finally said to him, we have to stop doing this because there is nothing that is resolved. There is nothing that is learned. This is hours and hours and hours of fear and speculation. And I don't see what the value of that is. And I think we were all sort of, you know, everyone was sort of ramping up and trying to figure out how to believe this and what to think about it. And, you know, you as an adult, as a reporter, as a crime fiction author, as a semi-intelligent person, you realize, and I think this is exactly the point of The First to Lie, you realize that people who have a stake in a thing are going to try to get you to believe what they want you to believe that will help them in whatever their goal is with the thing. So whether it's the virus or whether it's this specific and fictional pharmaceutical product in the first to lie, everybody has a reason for saying what they're saying. And I think, I mean, if I can be a fan here, I think that that's one of the reasons that Dr. Fauci has caught everyone's attention, is that he is one of the few people that seems to just be telling the pure truth. And you know from my books, and you know from talking that, you know, our talking in the past about The Murder List and Trust Me, my first standalone, is that this is what I think about all the time. What is truth, and what do we believe, and who do we believe, and why is somebody telling us this? And I, that analytical thinking about whatever it is that you're thinking about, whatever it is you're listening to, is so necessary and so critical. And I hope that I've learned to do that as a reporter over the years, is think, why would you say that? Why are you doing that? Why are you trying to convince me of that? Why is this your truth? Why is this your truth? And that's the essence of the first to lie, this sort of calculus of some greater good versus some smaller personal harm. But that personal harm is harming one person. So how does a pharmaceutical company, even a good one, how do they decide how many people it's all right to harm if you help the many? And that's a tough, impossible call, because if you're one of the people who gets harmed, you are going to think about that equation in a different way than if you're the one who's trying to sell millions of dollars of product and I don't want to let this go, and help a lot of people at the same time. And so when I talk about a big picture problem, like a pharmaceutical company who's doing X, Y, and Z thing, maybe. In my books, yes, the milieu, the sort of setting for the book is in Boston, and the part of it is about a pharmaceutical company, but the real book is about the individual people and how they're affected by what a bigger entity is trying to convince them of. What do they want, and what do they need, and what do they yearn for and long for and desire, and what's factored into that, and how do people try to convince them to do what they want them to do, and why, and how finally gaslighting and deception and manipulation is just as powerful as a gun or a knife to convince someone, just as powerful a weapon. So that's what really fascinates me, is how what we want drives us to action and drives us to try to convince someone else that what we are saying is true. So going back to what your initial question was about COVID, you know, I think as a reporter, we have to say, who is saying this and why are they saying this and what do they want us to think and why? I've seen on television now something that I've never seen, and this is one of the tectonic plate shifts, I think, of the COVID virus situation, is that now you see journalists saying, you know, speaking truth to power in a different kind of way, and saying, you know, that's just not true. That's just demonstrably not true. And I think in the past, that might not have been done as often. And now it is very noticeable to me, isn't it to you, that we're hearing that? We're hearing people just say, that's just not true.
Want to grow as a writer and take your writing to the next level? Give Pro Writing Aid a try. Pro Writing Aid is a grammar checker, style editor, and writing mentor in one package. Pro Writing Aid will never replace a human editor. Rather, it helps you self-edit to a deeper level so that when you send it off to an editor, they will be able to focus on the meat of your writing and not spend their time fixing basic writing issues. Pro Writing Aid is the only platform that offers world-class grammar and style checking, combined with more in-depth reports to help you strengthen your writing. Our unique combination of suggestions, articles, videos, and quizzes makes writing fun and interactive. writing can be grammatically perfect but still feel awkward and clumsy. Pro Writing Aid searches out elements like repetitiveness, vague wording, sentence length variation, over-dependence on adverbs, passive voice, overcomplicated sentence structures, and so much more. Nothing makes a writer lose credibility faster than spelling and grammar mistakes. Submit clean, error-free writing. Go to ProWritingAid.com and use code HANK20 for 20% off of Pro Writing Aid Premium. Pro Writing Aid. Check it out today. Yes, and the stories are evolving, and people are forming opinions, and hopefully we get some solid science as this thing evolves, or we understand the science that we have, and things become more clear. I think the unknown has scared so many people. Is it, you know? And then we look to our scientists and say, "Well, you're supposed to know," and like, "Well, we just don't know. It's brand new." And right. I think that scares a lot of people.
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, the idea that right. there's a process. That if you think thing A on day one, then realizing that the reality is thing D on day 27 doesn't mean you were wrong. It just means here's the evolution of what's happening. Right. This is what experimentation is. This is what research is. This is what education is. This is what exploration is. And the fear that I have is that, you know, people, it's not only what somebody else tells us, it's what we tell ourselves. And if we tell ourselves, it'll be fine, it can't happen to me, you know, it doesn't matter, this isn't true, everything is going to be great, this blanket of magical thinking that somehow it isn't real, you can't will it to be not real.
Right.
And that's what scares me quite a bit. How easily we can believe ourselves. I never thought about it that way, but that is the key. And we as human beings can do that to our benefit. You know, when you think about Rodgers and Hammerstein's "Whistle a Happy Tune," whenever I feel afraid, I whistle a happy tune and I'm no longer afraid. You can convince yourself that things are okay. You know, as a reporter and as a public speaker and as an author, I'm putting myself out there and I often sound very confident and I'm not at all, but I can make myself believe that everything will be okay. But this is not like that. You know, this is not like, you know, just get a grip and do it. This is a scary, real scientific thing. And if I could just say, the virus doesn't care what you think. That's the part that I think people need to remember.
Well, and I think we're going to see some interesting things come out of this in the near future. One, the art that's created out of this, I think, is going to be spectacular. I can't wait to see the books that come out next year, you know, written by people that were going through this. And I think it should make us lean on each other a little more. Maybe not physically lean on each other, but you know, we have to depend on one another when you know the times are so weird, you know, and maybe this brings our humanity out a little more.
Well, you have to hope so. I mean, I think the idea of creativity, I mean, one of the things that it sometimes brings out is selfishness in people.
Yeah.
So I think the more we can understand that people are going to behave differently and feel differently and react differently, potentially, is important to remember. And I, you know, I'm sitting here trying to write my 13th book, and it will come out, if all goes as planned, next year sometime. And what do I do about this? Do I put the virus in it? Do I not? Do I set it at a different time altogether? I can tell you right now, and it might change, but the book begins at the Emmy Awards ceremony. And I think, ooh, I wonder, and she's talking about how looking out over the crowded audience. And I think, I wonder if people will believe that. And I wonder if I should just say it's 2019. I mean, I honestly know a lot of people who are writing books and it's set in 2019 because there's no way to deal with it. And I was reading an article about the pandemic of 1918 and how little literature there is about that, how few books were written about that. Because the writer's theory was that people just didn't want to think about it anymore. When it was over, they wanted it to be over. And after that came the Roaring Twenties. you know, people were just out carousing and drinking and having fun and just forgetting that they'd been through this terrible time. So it'll be interesting to see what happens after this, whether anybody wants to read about it. I mean, I have a scene in my new book. Again, it's all a roughest of rough drafts that nobody on the planet will ever be allowed to see. But there's a scene in it where someone looks out over Copley Place in Boston and is happy that the food trucks are out again and the commuters are out again and it's bustling again. And she remembers that she had a family member who died in 2020. And she has a little gray ribbon that she wears that I sort of decided that everybody who had a person they love die in the pandemic has a gray ribbon. Now, where did I just made that up? You know, do I want to put that in or do I not want to put that in? And that's one of the joys of writing, isn't it? That I can put that in today and I can take it out tomorrow and I can put it back in the next day. So we will see what happens about that. But when I talk to other authors about what they're doing vis-a-vis the pandemic in their books, it just starts a huge conversation, the bottom line of which is that nobody has any idea. What do you think?
All of that. I think there's going to be really interesting stories. And of course, we'll get, you know, people that write things that are just kind of pretty on the nose about what's going on. But I think the really interesting stuff is going to be where people are kind of peeling back the layers of our humanity and how we interact with one another and what times like this brings out in people. I think that's going to be what's really going to be fascinating.
Well, you see, it's sort of noble, you know, the veneer of civilization is just sort of peeling away, as you say. There are so many people who just think this is an opportunity for them to do whatever they want to do.
Right.
Which is pretty terrifying.
That's
when you talk about the greater good versus the selfish personal good. I think that has come to the fore tremendously right now.
Exactly. Well, we're here today to talk about your new book, which is out available everywhere now. It's called The First to Lie. We touched on it briefly about there's an underlying story thread about this pharmaceutical company and a drug they've developed. And it seems to be a wonder drug, and it's going to just be amazing for all of these people. But there is a darker side effect of a side effect that we're seeing.
Isn't there always?
Right. And so we've got that storyline, but then we have these three characters that we kind of get to experience this book through: Nora Quinn, Ellie Berenson, and Meg Wiest. Which came to you first? Was it the idea for this plot, this sinister thing in the background? Was it the characters? I'm fascinated by that first inkling of a story, that first kernel that then grows and grows and grows into this finished process or this finished product. What was it for you? How did the story begin for you?
Well, that I love that question, and I love that moment. I completely understand what you're talking about altogether. And my answer to this is sort of twofold, because it's me, I get two answers. Because the first answer is inadequate but hilarious. And that is, I had, and you will be surprised, and that is, I had the title first. And
interesting.
The reason that I had the title first was when I was writing my book, The Murder List, which is now a USA Today bestseller, which I'm so thrilled about, and also nominated for the Agatha Anthony McCavity and Mary Higgins Clark Award, which is the only book to be nominated for all those. So that's really good. But
let me just interject this, one of the best audiobooks of last year. I read the ARC that your publisher sent, but then after we talked, I listened to the audiobook and I just loved it that much more. So one of the best audiobooks of last year as well.
Well, that's interesting, because Angela Daw, who read the Murder List, I first heard her read it. I was in an airport, remember airports? And I got an airport waiting lounge, and I got an email from my editor saying, here is the first clip of the audiobook for The Murder List. And I popped in my earbuds, and there were millions of people swarming around me. I pop in my earbuds and I push play, and I completely heard the voice of Rachel North. I mean, I Honestly,
don't you love it when that happens?
I almost burst into tears in the airport waiting lounge because there was my book come to life. So thank you. And I will tell Angela that you said so because I am thrilled with it. And the person who reads The First to Lie, Cassandra Campbell, is the same woman who read Where the Crawdads Sing. So it's really fascinating how her voice was so different in Delia Owens' book as it than it is in The First to Lie. So anyway, but thank you. You can interject how much you love The Murder List any time you want. So I was writing The Murder List, and in it, one of the characters was talking to a police officer, and the police officer was saying to her, well, you know, the first to talk is the first to walk. Meaning the first to rat out someone else is the first one to get the lighter sentence or to get off of a crime, be treated more leniently in the crime. The rat gets, the one who walks gets the good treatment. And my character in the book said, I know, but what about the first to lie? And I thought, oh, what about the first to lie? And the interesting thing about this, Hank, in saying this is that I know that I said it because I'm the author, but my character really said it sort of unbidden. I mean, I didn't make her say it. It was just her response to when he said the first to talk is the first to walk. And she says, what about the first to lie? Because she's cynical and because she also has ulterior motives. So I thought, well, there's my title. There's my title of my new book, because my books are always about that, about truth and lying and deception and manipulation and gaslighting and psychology. And the first to lie seemed like a good jumping off point. And then the real gem of, so then you have the question, what is the first to lie going to be about? What is the story going to be? And I've been a television reporter for 43 years, and I've wired myself with hidden cameras and confronted corrupt politicians and chased down criminals and gone undercover and in disguise. And it was that hidden camera undercover in disguise experience that really informed this book. I went undercover into a doctor's office once as a woman pretending to be someone who wanted to get pregnant in order to find out whether the doctor would reveal his malpractice history to me. Because the head of the Board of Registration in Medicine in Massachusetts at that time had told me that doctors were supposed to reveal that, disclose that to potential patients, because you couldn't find that out in a doctor's permanent record at the medical board. A patient would have to go to court to find out a doctor's malpractice history. And this person, this executive director, told me that doctors would just tell you. So I said, no, they won't. No, you're kidding me. A doctor is not going to tell me they have a bad malpractice history. Forget about it. So the only way to find out the truth about it was for me to go undercover, not as a reporter, and find out whether a doctor would really tell a person who was a patient, not a reporter, the truth about their legal history. So I had on like 3 sweatshirts to make myself look a different size, and over that a work shirt, and my hair all pulled up on top of my head, and no makeup, and big glasses, you would not recognize me. And replacing one of the buttons on the work shirt was a camera lens we called button cam. And then the cord from that button cam snaked underneath my sweatshirt and into a fanny pack, a geeky fanny pack that I was wearing that had the guts of the camera rolling inside. And he told me, and it was video only, because you can't record audio without permission in Massachusetts. He said to me, when I said to him, do you have a history of malpractice losses? And I knew he did. And I said to him, do you have a history of malpractice losses? Just so I know, just so I know. And he says, oh no, I have no malpractice losses.
And oh no.
That was just not true. He was just lying. And we did this. I went with my producer, who was a man, and he pretended to be my husband. And we did this in several doctors' offices, and no one told us the truth about their malpractice histories. And as a result of that story, the rules in Massachusetts were changed so that those histories are disclosed in each doctor's record at the Board of Registration in Medicine, and they're easy for potential patients to access. Not that they would make a decision not to go to that particular physician as a result of that, but just so they would know. You know, malpractice cases can be a pretty much cost of doing business things for doctors, and we understand that. But my thought was, a patient needs to know. So I thought about going undercover and how I had not only had the doctor lied, right, but I was lying. I was pretending to be someone that I wasn't. But I was saying, for me, that was the greater good. So then I started thinking, what about that? What if, you know, to go undercover and lie for the greater good, okay. What about going undercover and lying for a bad result? What if going undercover, you were doing something to get revenge or because you were obsessed with something? And what if, and then I started thinking, what if being someone else could get you what you want? Or what if going so far undercover that you actually believed that you were the other person? What about that? And then I started thinking, and forgive me, I know I'm talking fast, but then I started thinking about how, as a reporter, I'm undercover too every day in my stories, because you don't know how I feel about them. You don't know if I was terrified going out covering that story. You don't know what I left out. You don't know how I decided to put that story together, or what external forces were in play about how that story would eventually appear on the air. So as a reporter, I have to cover up my own personality and my own thoughts and my own feelings in the story. So in The First to Lie, though, I, as a reporter, could come out from undercover in my fictional reporter and reveal to people what it's really like to go undercover as a reporter, what might really happen, what are the legal ramifications, why would you make that decision, why would you put yourself in a position of being a liar, for better or for worse. So that, you know, that kind of undercover, how we all are undercover every day. You know, I speak to you differently than I would speak to a stranger. I speak to my husband differently than I would speak to my boss. You know, it's... we all have this persona that we put on. We're all acting all the time. And what happens if somebody decides to really be that other person? When is it okay to lie? And when it's life and death, what do a few lies really matter if you think you're doing the right thing? And that's where The First to Lie came from. And there's a thing on Twitter, I think it is, that's tell about your book in four words. And the four words for The First to Lie are betrayal, motherhood, obsession, and revenge. And you note that I didn't say pharmaceutical company or drug company or anything like that, because the essence of The First to Lie is betrayal, motherhood, obsession, and revenge. Two smart women facing off in a high-stakes cat and mouse game to get revenge after a terrible childhood betrayal. But which woman is the cat and which woman is the mouse?
Noveler is the best way to write a novel. Why? Quite simply because we've made it the easiest place to do it. Writing a novel is hard enough. Noveler takes care of all the logistical bits of writing a novel, just leaving that small matter of the words to you. It's a clean, beautiful writing interface with writing analytics, goals and streaks, advanced grammar checking, version control, day, evening, and night modes, and many other features designed to take all the stress out of writing. Tell us what you need and we'll build it. Together, we'll build a better tool. With a design-led approach, all the right tools that you need, Noveler saves all your words constantly, allows you to manage and order your novel easily. It's accessible from any device, desktop or mobile. It syncs to Google Drive and Dropbox. It allows exports in various formats, including ebook and more. It also has nice touches like allowing you to write both offline and online, unique for a web-based platform. Everyone needs help with their writing, from inspiration through to grammar checking, so we're doing our best to provide that support. we integrate that support directly into Noveler. Our advanced grammar checker powered by Pro Writing Aid does everything from spell check to style advice. Our writing courses include the incredible Tim Clare's Couch to ADK. We're really excited to offer all Author Stories listeners 30% off Noveler for a whole year. And it doesn't matter if you choose to sign up for the monthly or annual plan. You'll get 30% off. All you need to do is use the discount code Hank when you sign up. Noveler, N-O-V-L-R. That's Noveler.org. So deliciously deceptive. And you're right. The pharmaceutical company thread of this story is really an instigator to get feelings riled up, for lack of a better way to describe it.
To get reaction and to get motivation and to get a necessity for doing something. You know, in a good book, I think things happen because of something else. So the pharmaceutical company is sort of the first domino that falls. And the result of that is everything that really happens to the people. And that's what I really care about. So I love your way of saying instigator. That's a word that I'll swipe now.
You're welcome.
That is exactly what it is. So because I don't, you know, it's not really a store. It's not really a book about a pharmaceutical company. It's about the people who are affected by what has happened as a result of what the company may or may not be doing or thinking or caring about or wanting.
Right. And there's this really interesting thing that happens when we're talking about doctors or pharmaceutical companies, kind of like you talking about going undercover to visit that doctor and just wanting him to tell the truth, which he ultimately didn't do. And then we saw change come out of that. But that's a special kind of breach of trust, is that it's like we put more trust and we expect more out of people when it comes to our health. And it's a special kind of betrayal when you start talking about things like that.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way. And I love that, because I was thinking, you know, if a doctor vows first to do no harm. So that, you know, what he said to me was a lie. And what he said to me indicated that he wanted me to do something, meaning have him as my doctor, more than he wanted me to know the truth.
Right.
And so how am I supposed to understand everything else that he would tell me after that, if I knew that he'd lied to me about that? You know, it, you know, as your mom always said, you know, just, you know, one lie leads to another. That's why the first line of the first to lie is lies have a complicated half-life. Because the vestiges of them are always there. And once you start telling them, the liar has to remember it. And somebody else is going to remember it. And, you know, it's very hard to juggle, even if you think that your lies are for a good reason.
Well, a story like this wouldn't have the dramatic effect that it does if there weren't characters that inhabit the story that we care about and we want to root for, and we want to see, we want to follow along as the story unfolds. Ellie Berenson is an interesting character for me. Do you have a special kinship with her?
Well, Ellie is a reporter in this book, and she is on the trail of this pharmaceutical company. And she, you know, her goal is to find the documents that prove that the company knows that this particular drug, which they have been pushing off label, which they are not allowed to do, for use to encourage pregnancies in women, that they know that it harms some people, not many, and certainly not always. And she knows that some people are very helped by it. And she's sort of concerned with the ethical dilemma of, well, what if it does help a lot of people? And her bottom line, and I think this is about on page two, her bottom line is, just tell me the truth. Just tell me the truth as a patient and let me decide. And that's sort of a thread that goes through this book, is people just clamoring for disclosure. Just tell me and let me decide. And one of the things that I love about Ellie is that what I hope she does for readers is empower them to the next time they go to the doctor to think about what Ellie does and what Nora does and what Meg does and, you know, what other characters do in doctor's offices and how they might ask different questions now. Everybody needs to be allowed to make a decision based on the full disclosure, and then they can decide whatever they want. But to make a decision based on what somebody tells you when it's only half the story, you know, that's just the path to disaster. You know, and the thing that I was talking about earlier, which is so relevant to Ellie, is that, you know, I, as a reporter, you don't know what I think when I'm doing a story. But in the book, you know, you're with Ellie, you're on the trail with Ellie, you're on the road with Ellie, and you know what her goals are. And so you know that you can understand and judge the decisions that she makes in her journalism, because you know pretty much what's behind those decisions and why she's doing what she's doing. And that is a different way of looking at a news story. And that's why I like her too, because I love that she's ethical and moral and knows her law and knows her stuff and is a good journalist. But she wants something, you know, she wants something. So, you know, this is one of the things we were talking about before about COVID, is if you want something to be true, you can often figure out a way to convince yourself why it's okay. You know, and that is one of the biggest pitfalls of being a reporter, is to say to yourself, it's fine, I can do it, it's fine, nobody will notice, it's fine, this is okay, I can cut a corner, and nobody will ever know. And you know, nobody will ever know is the worst possible thing that a journalist could ever say, because somebody will know, and it will be terrible. Ellie is very, very motivated to do what she's doing, and she has her reasons for that. So I loved having her struggle with her honor versus her passion and her desires, because that's a tough thing.
Absolutely. When we talked about how this story began with a title for you, I take it that's not an always occurrence. Stories begin in different ways for different people. But typically, how long does a story idea kind of sit with you before you feel confident enough to start writing, that you have a grasp of kind of a meta story before you start working on it?
Oh, that's such an interesting question, because I think that because I have a contract to write a book a year, the story sits with me for like 0 minutes. It's, you know, I think that it's sort of the before that is the interesting part, is that I somehow, just as I can do as a journalist, some sort of blink reflex in my brain understands what a good story might be, what idea might hold an entire book, you know, what idea might hold an entire investigation. Sometimes they're just not big enough to do that. And you just need, as you say, that little core, that little germ of the idea that you can see can be planted and grow into an important, compelling, riveting, page-turning thriller, which is what I'm going for. So I know, first of all, I don't think you can look for an idea like that. I think at some point the universe, and this is so silly sounding, but I think that at some point the universe just presents you with the idea. When it's the time for the idea, something will happen, or you'll see something or hear something or think of something, and you think, oh, that's my book. You know, that has happened to me every single time that I have written, and I'm writing my 13th now, and every single time I've gotten the idea. Now, there are days when I don't have the idea, and I'm thinking to the universe, any day now, in time, I am ready for that idea. And it, knock on wood, it has always arrived. So once I know what that is, what that gorgeous thing is, I sit down and start writing chapter one. Now, I don't know anything that happens after that. You know, I have no idea. I don't have an outline. I don't have a synopsis. I write chapter one, and I see what, you know, the other thing is, if I can, I have to get my first line. If I don't have the first line, I can't really start. So I have the idea and a first line, and then I just go. And that's what, and by go, I mean crawl up a blank slate wall with my fingernails, clawing my way to the top. I just write the next paragraph and the next scene and the next chapter. And that's what gets me to the computer every day is I think, I wonder what's going to happen next. I wonder what's going to happen. And the only way to find that out is for me to write it.
There's a subtle mindset difference in what you're saying and the way different people approach it. Some people would say, I don't have an idea, therefore I can't write. You say, I have a paragraph, and then I trust that the rest will come. When some people experience what they call writer's block, and they just feel like they can't write because they don't have anything there, whereas you say, I don't have anything, but I know I can do this, and then I'll trust the rest will come. Do you differentiate that? Do you see that as a difference? And is it just a mindset thing? Is writer's block real? Do you ever think I just can't go on because I don't know what comes next?
Every day. I think that every day. I mean, I'm not even kidding. I think it every day. And I say to myself, okay. And I say to myself, you are terrible. You are the worst writer that's ever existed. I don't know how you wrote those other books because you certainly forgot and you can't possibly write any more books and you're just going to have to give the money back because you can't do this. Forget about it. And then I say, okay, I can't, I'm terrible. It's terrible. I'm just going to write one more terrible sentence. And then my brain says, it's going to be terrible. And then I say, yes, it is. It's going to be terrible. And I'm going to write another terrible sentence because you can just write. I mean, this sounds so silly, but I just write anything, because at some point, if you write anything, your brain will sort of get in gear and get engaged. And the thing that you're supposed to be writing will evolve. And then you think, oh, that's what this all is. Okay, well, then that's not really so bad. You know, then you think, and actually part of that is kind of good. And then you mine out what works and delete what doesn't work. So, you know, one of the things I think that causes writer's block, whatever that is, and certainly we've all had a thing where we think, I can't do this. I mean, of course you can't do it. It's really hard to be a writer. It's hard. If it's not hard, if you're just sitting there banging out words, it's not going to be very good. I mean, all of us have days, and I just crave them, the days where the ideas are flowing and that, you know, it's almost as if you're not even thinking of it. It's just coming from the universe through and out your fingers and onto the page. And you think, whoa, who wrote that? That's a pretty interesting. We have those days. And then there are days where you just think, I don't have any idea. And that's what being a writer is to me. You know, it's some days it's fabulous and some days it's horrible. So there you have it. And, you know, you decide what you're going to do. And some days it's really hard. I mean, like right now for me, it's really hard. But you know what I've learned to do? It's interesting because as a reporter, I'm going out and searching for the story, right? If I knew what the story was, it wouldn't be news, you know? So I'm finding a new thing. I'm looking for the story. So that's sort of how I have learned to think about writing fiction is that I am just looking for the story. Let me see if it's this way. Let me see if it's this way. Let me see if it's this way. And eventually the story that I'm looking for emerges. And then I keep writing along that path. And then I go back and take out the things that didn't work. That's my favorite part, is to go through, on the first revision of the terrible, terrible first draft and say, I don't need that part. I don't need that part. And I also say, oh, that's what that meant. Oh, I didn't realize when I wrote that. That's what that was. Okay, perfect. So I think people are used to thinking about school when they had to do an essay and then they turned it in and then the teacher said A or F and it was done. But that isn't what, and that can make you kind of frantic and terrified. But if you think of your book that way, but a book isn't like that. A book is, you can go back and you can fix it and you can tweak it and polish it and change it and do anything you want to it. And there's no teacher where you have to turn it in tomorrow who's going to stamp a big F on it. You know, it's a process. It's a work in process. And so if you think, well, you know, tomorrow will be better and tomorrow I'll fix this bad sentence that I wrote today. And you just go on and you don't, you know, Sue Grafton used to say, and in that her wonderful accent, she'd say, "You're just writing a book. You know, it's not nuclear war. Get over yourself." You know, and I think I hear her voice saying that all the time because, you know, she's so right. We tend to get kind of frantic and overwhelmed with the bigness of it. You know, just write another line or two, then write another line or two, and eventually you'll get your story.
Well, the new book is called The First to Lie. There are links to it in the show notes of this episode where you can grab the hardcover or the Kindle edition or my personal favorite, the audiobook. Hank, if people are just discovering you and want to dig into all of the great stuff that you do and your magnificent back catalog, where can they find you online?
Oh, you know, they can find me everywhere. It's very sad. On Facebook, on Facebook too much, and Instagram too much, at Hank P. Ryan, and Twitter at Hank P. Ryan. My website is hankphillippyryan.com. And if you click on that website, if you click on contact on that website, your email will come right to me. Nobody in between. I see all my email personally. So find me on Facebook. I'm on social media way too much. That's why I have to set a timer for my writing. So I promise myself that for 34 minutes in a chunk, I will not look at those things. But after my first 34 minutes, I get to go check and see if you've emailed me or Insta'd me. So please contact me. I would love to hear from readers. I love it more than anything. So Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, my website. I have a couple of blogs, Career Authors, which is a wonderful sort of news you can use for people who want to make their living as a writer, Career Authors, and Jungle Red, which is a wonderful reader-writer group of women mystery authors, including Deborah Crombie and Reese Brolin and Jed McKinley and Hallie Efren and Lucy Burdett and Julia Spencer Fleming. It's a wonderful blog where we talk absolutely every day. And also, First Chapter Fun. Do you know about First Chapter Fun?
I do.
With Hannah Mary McKinnon and I, every Tuesday and Thursday, days that begin with T, on Instagram and Facebook, Hannah Mary McKinnon and I, the wonderful best-selling Canadian author, read out loud the first chapter of a new book. It takes about 20 minutes. It's like story time for adults, and it's live, so what could go wrong? So your myriad listeners can find me on all those places, and I hope they do.
We will round up all of those links and put them in the show notes of this episode to make it easy for people to find you and connect with you. The First to Lie, one of my favorite books of the summer. I know it will be yours too. Hank, thank you so much for joining me again on the Hank and Hank Show.
Always a pleasure, my favorite. You are the best interviewer and the best questioner. And I just looked at the time and I thought, oh my goodness, how did this happen? You are fabulous. Thank you, Hank, so much.
Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community.